Accession number 19911, Reel 3.
Lord Reel 3. We did have occasion to go into the nearby village to load up with supplies for the platoon, and it was night time. The ruins of the village lay there before us, and there were these huge pits caused by the bombing, and I should use the word craters, these huge craters. I noticed in one huge crater there were about a dozen bodies lying on stretchers. So there as we waited, I gazed at this long line of dead bodies covered with blankets, and with the eerie light playing all around, it was a dreadful scene. I don't know what the delay was, it seemed an awful long time. I was getting impatient, because I knew very well that come the first night, there would be a certain German gunnery outfit having us pinpointed. So I was a bit anxious to get back to the safety of our trenches. And come first light, we got back to our trenches and put the breakfast on. You remember, at least most soldiers will remember how we cooked, and that was, of course, we used to have a biscuit tin with holes in, filled with earth. Petrol was poured on this, and then it was ignited with a Dixie or whatever it was above. And we had some very, very good rations: tin bacon, tin sausages, tin plum duff, and biscuits, of course, cigarettes, chocolate, and even toilet paper. The army really spoiled us. This particular morning, we'd come back to the trenches, got the breakfast on, and then no sooner had we settled, ready to eat something, than we had the German artillery outfit opening up on us, and it was just time to dash back to the trench. Well, my trench was the nearest, and then as I got in with my, I still carried my mess tin with my breakfast, another three fellows followed me. Can you imagine? Four people trying to share a slit trench made for one, and there was... Then, of course, there was an almighty crashes and bangs, and one particular shell dropped so near the trench, nearly showering us with earth, that I looked at my mess tin when the deluge finished, and there was my breakfast, you know, gone forever, and I cursed the whole German nation. However, c'est la guerre. We were not disappointed in the least to be told that we were withdrawing from Freneville and going to an area not very far away from Caen. It wasn't all that distant, actually, but the rain, the incessant rain, had churned up the, at least the tanks had churned up the ground awfully badly. And as we pulled out at night time, we were relieved by another regiment. Of course, I always remember that some of them were on the small side, and when they got into our trenches, of course, they were far too deep, so there they were. Some of them almost disappeared. However, we pulled out at night time, and the Germans were quiet, and there we were riding in the carriers through all the thick slush and mud, mostly caused by the tanks churning it up, turning the ground up. And I looked at one or two of the columns of the rifle companies trudging by, and of course it was much harder for them. We were in luxury compared to them. We pulled back to a place called Gibberville, which is Gibberville, I can't remember, I don't know what the pronunciation is, Gibberville, I would think, and just an outside of Caen. And here on a huge sort of hillside, I say a hillside, it was quite a slope, we encamped, and most of the Guards Armour Division was in that same area. We were in view of the enemy there, which seems strange to me, but it was evidently intended that we should do, so we could continue to pin down the German armour opposite to us. This area, we thought it was where we were encamped, we thought it was pretty safe, but the German Luftwaffe came over on a night time and bombed us. But fortunately, it was only one casualty in our platoon, only one wounded, and we settled in pretty well there for a day or two. I remember going into Caen to collect with people of the other carriers, and going to collect some new vehicles, and I saw some of the devastation of Caen. Afterwards, of course, I would read of the terrible casualties that happened there to the civilian population. And at the time, of course, I looked around at some of the, shall I call it, I don't want to be disparaging here, some of the base troops, the chaps walking around who behind the lines, who were quite necessary, the supply people and all like that. But when realising it took about, I don't know, 10, 15 people, maybe more, to keep one man in the front line, you think what a debt is owed to the infantry or any of the front line troops. The next move came to another part of Normandy, and here the Guards Armoured Division was involved with quite another number of units of the British 2nd Army in trying to advance through Normandy. Now, quote Normandy to anyone who took part in the battles there, and their minds are filled with memories of tall hedgerows, of small fields, of continual fighting from one field to another field, of tanks grinding their way, of noise, of dust, and all the desperation involved in it. Our casualties became very heavy in the battalion. The carrier platoon was split up at this point and maintained support in various different roles. It was almost confusing, was the number of moves which were made at this, from one map reference to another map reference, from one field to one to another wood and so on. All accompanied by various horrors and so on. When we arrived at the beginning, it was at a particular point, which I think is Saint Martin des Bessars or something like that. Saint Martin, we call it Saint Martin in Normandy. It was evening, and we were detailed, our section, to do a recce, but on foot. So off we went up a huge hill to the side, and as we trailed along in the darkness, don't forget we'd had a tiring day already, and there again, here we were at night time on a night patrol, and we covered quite a lot of ground without a trace of any of the enemy. And we came to a cottage in the middle of a clearing, and French people came out to us, and Billy Wrigglesworth, our sergeant, he was asking them about the nearness of any of the German troops, and as he was interviewing them, if I can use the word interview, which seems a bit peculiar, there came a shot, and more shots, and then looking down into the valley, because the light this time, the dawn was beginning to approach, you could see the mortar bombs exploding very vividly. And we said hurried goodbye, and we were off to rejoin the rest of the our platoon and the rest of the battalion down below in the valley. And we got so far along, and we saw then a Sherman tank coming towards us, and with one or two other tanks behind it. And as we approached the Sherman tank, there was a terrific bang, and up went the tank in flames. Billy told me to keep an eye open by the side of the field we were in, It was almost impossible because alongside me was a huge hedgerow. I couldn't see through it. And there was an awful din starting to arise from then. Bangs, crashes, bullets flying. And Billy and another sergeant were trying to help one or two of the tank crew had managed to get out of the burning tank. And Billy shouted to me, he said, "You might as well go, Eric, get down to the rest of the platoon." So where the rest of the section had gone, I presume they'd already vanished. Anyway, off I goes, and as I'm striding down the hill at a fairly fast pace, I see a section of all the rifle companies coming up, and there they were, half crouched, because there was a fair amount of stuff flying around, and I was bouncing down the hill, trying not to make it too hurried, but at the same time making sure I was performing at a fair pace. And of course they pulled me up, there was an officer there, two or three officers, and with a section of the rifle company coming up the hill. And they started to ask me about what was going on up there, and how the hell could I say anything? And I felt such an idiot afterwards, because yeah, I was frightened, but I was not as frightened as what the impression I was giving. So I felt ashamed of this, and all I could tell him was I knew nothing. And one sergeant looked at me suspiciously from the rifle company, and he said, "Where are you going?" As though I was retreating. So I was going to make some wisecrack, and I thought, well, I'd better not. I told him I'd orders to go back and join the rest of the platoon. So anyway, I departed, feeling a little bit ashamed of myself. Went down to then join the rest of the platoon. Found Tupler Buff, my other colleague, he was the driver of our carrier, found Tupler Buff, he'd already dug a slit trench, or at least he was digging one, and I said, "Do you mind if I share it?" He said, "It's like Hellfire Corner around here." So I said, "It's like Hellfire Corner up there." He reluctantly let me share his slit trench, the miserable gentleman. And I noticed that the battalion headquarters were nearby, and they dug in all round defence. I thought it looks rather serious, this. Anyway, it started to quieten down. It quietened down all right. Some of the tanks there were the Irish Guards tanks. I forgot to say that the Irish Guards tanks were part of the attack force, and so they suffered heavy casualties. And I'm afraid that one of our companies also, I'm afraid they caught some casualties there, very sadly. And so the whole thing sort of became quiet, and then the next morning the battalion started to advance again. And so it all looks so magnificent. The tanks lining up, the Sherman tanks forming up behind, and then off you go. And it all looks, you know, so invincible. But of course, we knew by then, began to realise then, that the Sherman tanks were sitting targets for any German. The German tank far outgunned the Sherman, and as I say, the column moved off, and then down the road heading for goodness knows where, and then the shelling starts, and it's get off, you know, and then disperse and all the rest of it, and so the story goes on. The odd thing about the fighting in. You want to start again? About the fighting in Normandy was that in one field somebody could be winning a medal, two fields behind that somebody could be listening to the forces radio. Sometimes it was so desperate, and then other times everything would go quiet. I seem to remember there was an incident where the commanding officer with the artillery observation officer were wanting to do a recce for the next move of the battalion. And so with one or two other officers, we formed a sort of a guard to do a patrol. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and somehow, in our particular area, our part of the front, the Germans had retreated on that little sector. And here we were, strolling through the Normandy countryside. And all of a sudden, it became peaceful, and one could hardly imagine all the terrible things which were going on all around us. Of course, it didn't last very long. Just an incident which can pay tribute to Bill Wrigglesworth, the section sergeant. Dug in at one particular position, a couple of Germans came in through some bushes with their hands held high, And one of the members of the platoon said, shoot the bastards. Billy Riggers was turned round on him and he gave him such the biggest dressing down that I've ever heard. He called him all the names under the sun for making such a stupid remark. Full marks to Billy. He was a very, very cool, a very resourceful leader, Billy Wrigglesworth. I said about the odd things, the odd times when it seemed to go quiet. And prior to the last big attack, I remember that we were quartered in a field and there was a bath in the middle of this field for the benefit of the animals to drink from. And it was full of water, seemed fairly clean. And so I thought, here's a chance, because you could imagine what we were like living rough all the time. Here's a chance. So I stripped off and hopped in, much to the amusement of my comrades, stripped off and got in this bath and started with a bit of soap to have a bath. And at that time, just at that time when I was halfway through my bath, the Germans decided to put some air base just above us. You can imagine the alacrity with which I jumped out of that bath and managed to, get dressed again. The next sort of big thing which I remember after all the tumults and all the dust, the smells, the corpses, the graves hurriedly dug and so on. I think which I remember is the big attack which was put in on the battalion. And here, instead of the Irish Guards, we had Churchill tanks to support us. This was for the initial part of the attack. Now, before us lay a huge valley. The attack was put in at dawn, and the whole Carrick platoon, for once assembled, to go in down this road with the Churchill tanks on either side. So, there we were, and I said a prayer or two before we set off. And we rolled down this huge valley, down where the morning mists hadn't yet evaporated. And here we descended and rolled along, and the Churchill tanks, huge lumbering monsters, mind you, they're no more use than the Shermans compared to the German tanks. And then the firing started, of course. And here, with this huge panorama before me, it was possible to see both sides. Shells exploding, the Churchill tanks firing as they started to slowly climb up the slope. And then, as the leading carrier, we went leading, two or three carriers in front of us, as the leading carrier started to come up the road to go up the slope, it was hit. And the crew managed to bail out. In the arms of one of the fellows from the carrier was a dog. They had a dog with them. I thought, that's odd, having a dog with you in the middle of a battle. We dashed up the hill to the where the German trenches were, and fortunately on our little bit, where the Germans had decided to retreat. I don't blame them. But I did notice that the Germans had dug some very extensive fortifications over some very extensive deep trenches and dugouts. However, then up came the Sherman tanks with some of our own men, and they proceeded on to take over from there. So we were rather fortunate on that particular case that the Germans had decided to withdraw. The Germans eventually were in full retreat, of course, and eventually would be formed what they call the Fallet Gap, where the Germans would be pressed in from all sides. The battalion came to a stop at some particular peaceful part of the countryside, and there we were halted. The trenches were dug. We went up to join one of the companies and dug in alongside them. And it was decided that a section from the Carrick platoon would go out on foot and establish where the nearest Germans were. So it was Captain Fanning, who was the platoon commander, who assembled, took our section again. He seemed to be rather fond of using our section to do the patrol. And he led the way. And when I say he led the way, he was in command. No, he wasn't in front. It was me who was in the front, leading the way to do this patrol. With a Bren gun strapped around my shoulders. And this time, as I say, it was all peaceful. There wasn't even a just the odd muffled explosion here and there, but it was a beautiful, this beautiful summer's day, a Sunday if I remember. Peaceful cornfields were there. We filed through a deserted farm. The door on the farmhouse slowly swinging in the gentle breeze. Everything deserted. There was a burnt out Sherman tank. On we went, slowly through the countryside, across fields, and myself leading the way. We came to a sunken road, and there lying in this sunken road was a figure, a British soldier. He had been killed, and he formed a tragic picture, a lone figure. What he came to be there, whether there'd been a patrol and he'd been killed and the rest had been captured, goodness knows. Sadly, he was dead, and as we lay down there waiting to dash across a gap which existed in the hedgerow, we could no more but gaze forlornly at this sad figure. We crossed the gap, carried on until we came to a road, and across the other side of the road, the Germans, we heard the Germans, their half tracks. We observed that they were dug in there. They didn't see us though. Captain Fanning decided that we should open up on the Germans and then depart as quickly as we could. So very, very quietly and carefully, Ben guns were put over the side of the hedge and fired at the Germans who were dug in this field, unaware of our presence. The shattering of the Bren guns on a quiet Sunday afternoon made everybody very much aware that this was, hurry up and get out of it, because we're going to be in trouble if we didn't. And immediately after firing, he said, come on, and we all dashed away and hurtled back the way we'd come. And continuing up a grassy field, someone tripped. This is the silly thing that happened. Someone tripped, and then he brought the rest of them down, then up again and charging along until Captain Fanning said, look, look, slow down, slow down. And there were a few mortar bombs hurled in our direction as we made our long way back to the battalion lines. And we were very thankful, very hot, very tired, very thankful to get back all in one piece. A rather bizarre exploit. Captain Fanning was probably very, very pleased that we'd shot up some Germans. Anyway, we got back to the battalion position, the company was there. We joined the rest of our platoon. And we no sooner got a mug of tea on, this was the thing, tea. Got the tea on, and we're settling down. And one of the other sections of our platoon, the fellow there, he opened up on his Bren gun at a figure ahead, which was no man's land, I suppose. He'd seen a figure lurking. He'd seen us come in, pursued by mortar bombs. So this figure opened up. They went and brought the figure in. It was one of our own officers. It was an officer of one of the companies. The only young officer had just joined. And I looked at him. They brought him in on the stretcher. I looked at him, and nothing could be done for him. And the officer, the company officer, who looked at and said, oh well, he never upbraided the guardsman who had shot one of his own officers. Not a word was said. I suppose, that by now he was that used to all the terrible things of war, because by this time the battalion had lost an enormous number of killed and wounded. The battalion in a rest area presented a picture of orderly lines of vehicles and a less disciplined array of makeshift bivouacs and shelters. It was peaceful. Peace. The sun shone and seemed to shine every day. It was just glorious to have no bashes, loud bangs, crashes and all the rest of it. It was something of a holiday. However, that didn't prevent the authorities having a drill parade on a sloping hill, and you can imagine what a farce it was trying to do an orderly parade on a steep side of a hill. However, we survived. I always remember that one of our platoon, a chap called Tubby Evans, he should have been in the Welsh Guards, and I remember his telling us that he joined the Guards because he thought that in wartime or any other time, all they did was guard Buckingham Palace. I'm afraid he was in for a shock when he got himself into an infantry unit. The great advance came when the Germans were in full retreat, and the battalion set off with the tanks in pursuit of the Germans. It was a very long, protracted journey, and I myself sat in the back of a Bren gun carrier, was able to look out over the French scene, the French countryside. The River Seine was crossed. We came to a hill just outside Arras, and here we were got a bit of a shock when we were attacked by a couple of aircraft which dived and machine gunned us. And then later we found out they were Spitfires, which wasn't very happy. Arras itself was occupied by the enemy when we first entered it, and there was certainly opposition at one end of the town. As we entered the town, the crowds were out in force and cheering us and shouting, "Vive la Tommy," and "Vive long, I get it right, "Vive long days," and we shouted, of course, "Vive la France," what have you. It was an exhilarating experience. It wasn't exhilarating for everybody, because on this great advance through France and Belgium, some of the battalion were involved in skirmishes, and I'm afraid there were fatalities there, there were casualties. For the most part, as far as we were concerned, we followed the tanks and let them do all the hard work. Any opposition they met, and very successfully too, and we followed on. And this happened for day after day, until finally there came the great advance through Belgium to Brussels. It was the 3rd of September 1944, and it was evening when we entered Brussels. At first the suburbs were quiet, and then gradually as we entered the city, the crowds grew in density, and there they were cheering us on, and we felt like conquering heroes. It was a best part of war, the only part of war, I suppose, that's enjoyable. We stopped at a particular avenue, and then some sort of a garden place in the middle of the suburbs. And here we rendezvoused for the night. And then, next morning, we made our way through Brussels, a little more central position, and found billets in a school, of all places. We were told that we had a couple of hours to go out and enjoy ourselves, a very limited time. And so most of the members of the platoon, of my platoon, set off in different directions. The little crowd I was with made for the nearest bar, and in this crowded bar the drinks were free. After so long of sipping this indifferent beer, I took a walk by myself. I walked out of the bar, down this particular road, into another road, looking about me, and gradually